I wrote a parable this week. It goes like this. Lazarus owns a 1999 Dodge Neon. This is a car with a bit of Y2K disaster built right into its glove box. Lazarus's Neon, widely known as one of the 10 worst cars built that year, but Lazarus's Neon by now in 2017 is very rusty. Its leaky oil pan has stained the driveway forever. The wheels are out of alignment. It doesn't have any get up and go anymore. And foam stuffing is coming out of all of the seats. One day, when the brakes feel especially spongy, Lazarus takes his Neon to the Nazareth Auto Repair Shop. He lives in Nazareth, Pennsylvania. And in a moment of carefree optimism, Lazarus even asks the mechanics there to give his car a tune-up. It's been a long time since that car had a tune-up. Forever, in fact. Some car owners are like that, right? So anyways, the Nazareth mechanics get to work on that Neon, and they discover that the compression is way down in two of the cylinders, and if you don't know anything about how cars work, that's very bad. The spark plugs in this Neon, 20 years later, are original equipment. And the brakes need new rotors and discs all around. In fact, the Nazareth auto repair mechanics finally tell Lazarus that the car is not worth tuning up. It really needs a resurrection, which would cost at least $4,000, and that resurrection wouldn't even touch the upholstery or the rust. So the Nazareth mechanics advise Lazarus that he ought to buy another car instead, and actually they have a very good used Toyota right on their lot. So before he buys that new car, Lazarus goes home to consider his options. And Lazarus decides that, well, you know, he does not trust those Nazareth mechanics. You know, he doesn't trust them at all. In fact, he is going to stick with his old wreck. You see, Lazarus trusts how he feels about cars, just as many people today trust how they feel about spirituality. In fact, Lazarus trusts his feelings more than he trusts the Nazareth Auto Repair Shop's expertise, more than he trusts religion. And that's how it is for the church. When it comes to faith, whether it is rusty faith or no faith at all or faith overflowing, when it comes to faith, people tend to trust their intuitions and feelings or whatever they last read on the internet. They tend to trust that more than they trust the church as a religious institution. Of course, Lazarus' story is a parable. And so, of course, I'm exaggerating to make my point. I actually know that there are a lot of thoughtful people who pursue spirituality privately rather than in an institution like the church. I know people who have studied great religious prophets like Martin Luther or Martin Luther King, and maybe they've even read the Upanishads or the Quran, and they devote daily time, these individuals, to their intellect and their spirituality. But usually, when people say that they are spiritual but not religious, they are making the claim that they are spiritual based not on all this study, but they're making that claim based on their private feelings and intuitions. This is especially so, I think, for a very key and important reason. We live in an era where most of us, whether we go to church or not, most of us, all of us, are very, very skeptical about institutions in general. We don't trust government institutions because they go off to war, insisting on things like, well, we found weapons of mass destruction. And that doesn't do anything for our trust. Governments tax us way too much, we think. That doesn't do anything for our trust of institutions. You know, they can't build the subways or transit or run hydro the way we think such things should be done, and so we don't trust these institutions. In fact, people are skeptical of all institutions. Classrooms in our public schools are too crowded. Persons of color end up being carded and languish in jail much longer, much more often than white folks. Banks, we read in the news this past week, push their own investment instruments rather than the best ones for the customer, and then they charge way too much for doing so. Millennials, well, they can't find the jobs that they trained for, and when they finally do get a job, it's not a career, it's a gig. People are skeptical of institutions. They don't like them, they don't trust them. So what are they supposed to do? They mostly can't rid themselves of institutions. I mean, they can't take all their money out of the bank and then put it under a bed and be done with banks and still buy stuff on Amazon. People, they can't quit taking a car on publicly owned government-run roads. They can't quit taking that car to work because they're against the government or whoever puts the roads together. We can't stop being citizens of Canada or the United States and be citizens of nothing. We have no choice about belonging to that institution that's called the nation. Most institutions, even when we absolutely distrust them, most institutions can't be avoided. We are forced to participate. So to express their anti-institutional angst, one thing that many people do, I think often unconsciously, but one thing many people do is they decide they are going to leave those few institutions where they truly have a choice to leave, like the church or the Rotary Club, but especially the church. People reject Nazareth Motors because it satisfies, even if they're unconscious, but it satisfies their longing to thumb their noses at an institution because institutions bug them. Well, I'm here this morning to say that perhaps we ought not make such hasty decisions. The truth is that churches actually can do and do voluntarily, not because you have to or have to belong, but churches can and do amazing things, even though they have to organize into an institution to do it. Take, for example, one of the earliest examples of this from the history of the church, our scripture reading. In the very beginning, at the start of Jesus' new community called the church, these Christians, they encountered a problem. You see, idealists that these Christians were, kind of crazy, they had gotten into the habit of selling everything they had and bringing the money to the apostles and then sharing it with whoever had anything in need. Now, this is not a system that's guaranteed to work for very long, but they did it with the best of intentions. Except that some members were overlooked when it came to distributing the good stuff. The early church did right by the Jewish members of the congregation, but they ignored the Greek-speaking Gentile members who needed something. The Jewish members were well looked after, but the Greek-speaking widows were going hungry. To resolve this problem, the church did what churches do. It formed a committee called the Diaconal Committee, and it organized this committee in order to make it better. It selected several men, it was always men in those days, to make sure that the money was shared fairly among all the widows, regardless of the language they spoke or the country they were born in. And the amazing thing here, this is where the surprise comes in. The amazing thing is that the church selected, we can tell by the names that Margan read, the church selected only Greek-speaking men to take over complete control of all the church's finances, even the finances of the Jewish members. This is an amazing development for us. This would be like putting only people who have the biggest mortgages on the boards of the banks. This would be like putting only homeless people on the City Council of Toronto. This would be like allowing only First Nations people to work for the Department of Indigenous and Northern Affairs. I mean, incredibly idealistic on the part of the church to give all the power to the people who were being pushed to the fringe of the church. Very idealistic. Maybe it's unworkable. Yet this sort of risky, selfless, upside-down behavior is actually one of the things that organized religion does best of all. Churches are a time and a place and an opportunity for spiritual people to join hands with other spiritual people and learn together and work together for the good of all of humanity, even when it's at great personal cost and it doesn't seem like there's much self-interest in it. For example, we here in this congregation work together to bring refugees to Canada, even though we all know that when those refugees finally arrive, it's going to cost us big time in our time, never mind the money we spend on it. Here in this congregation, we contribute generously in our second collection today. We contribute generously to fund Camp Scugog, even when we personally don't know the impoverished kids who are going to be there. We encourage our city councilors and MPs, we pick up the phone personally and talk to them. We encourage them to keep on working for the least and the last in this city, even when it means more taxes for us because right is right. We insist together that our planet is a temple, and we will do what it takes politically and personally to keep it beautiful, even if it's our grandchildren who will benefit and not us anymore. We inspire our bankers to work for shareholder profit and the common good. And the bankers in this church do try. We remind each other that racism is not a matter of personal prejudice only, but racism is a matter of systems that wed personal prejudice to power. Systems that most of us as white people benefit from without thinking. And of course, we wonder about spirituality together in worship and in committees and in council and in meditation classes. Even though it takes a bit of time, we wonder and learn from each other. And sure, sometimes we as a church fail, like all institutions, and we even fail badly sometimes, as the church has failed with their partner, the Canadian government, on residential schools. But at other times, we in the church succeed spectacularly, even though many people forget, as when the United Church of Canada, at great cost to itself, was the first major Canadian institution to call for equal rights for gay people, both within and without the church. Or when we led the charge over and over again from the days of Vietnam through the decades to make Canada a welcoming home for refugees. So spirituality is great. It's inescapable. It's an inescapable human need, kind of like exercise or food. You can ignore it for a while, but you'll come back to it. But true and deep spirituality isn't merely a private feeling or an intuition. It is rather a potential we share together, especially working together in this institution, to become more deeply human, to become more like Christ or more like the Buddha, more connected to each other and the divine, not solely for our own private benefit, but for the good of each other and humankind. Baptism, beautiful baptisms today. Baptism and confirmation, that was very special for me too. But baptism and confirmation are for spiritual people who recognize this truth of needing each other for their spirituality and who commit themselves and their children to community where people prize spirituality and not only prize it, they want to supersize it by working together religiously. The truth is, we all begin to sag and rust and slow down when we try to do spirituality all alone or as an intuition or gut feeling. It's hard to keep a private spirituality firing on all of its cylinders. So what we all really need to do spirituality right, to keep our spirituality in good repair, is check in at the Nazarene repair shop here at church from time to time to tune our spirituality up. Spirituality. And when you do it that way, it's spirituality and religion. Thank you.